Health is wealth, and this is where we're going to talk about it. The Small Conversations for a Better World podcast with hosts Jillian McCormick and Susanna Steers. This podcast represents the opinions of the hosts and or their guests to the show. The content is for informational purposes only and should not be taken as medical advice nor established legal standard of care. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Small Conversations for a Better World podcast. I'm Susanna Steers.
And I'm Jillian McCormick. I'm so excited to have today's guest here on the show. So many personal hot buttons to be discussed with an individual who truly stands out in her field for lots and lots of reasons. So let me tell you the ways. Dr. Lori Brado is a professor in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at UBC. She is the Canada Research Chair in Women's Sexual Health and the Executive Director of the Women's Health Research Institute. She's a registered psychologist in British Columbia, the director of the UBC Sexual Health Laboratory, where research primarily focuses on developing and testing psychological and mindfulness-based interventions for women with sexual desire and arousal difficulties and women with chronic genital pain. Dr. Brado is an associate editor for the Archives of Sexual Behavior and has 170 peer-reviewed publications. She's frequently featured in the media on topics related to sexuality. Her book, Better Sex Through Mindfulness, How Women Can Cultivate Desire, is a trade book of her research demonstrating the benefits of mindfulness for women's sexual concerns. She is also a strong advocate for empowering women to take on leadership roles. We also need to add to this impressive bio, as just this week on Twitter, I noticed an announcement that, Lori, you received a UBC Faculty of Medicine Distinguished Researcher Award for 2019. I want to say congratulations and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you both so much. It's great to be here.
Lori, I get a feeling of local girl does good when I hear all of your accomplishments. Are you a local girl?
I am a local girl. I grew up in beautiful Surrey and grew up on a farm. My parents actually still live on that farm to this day. I went away for a few years for part of my schooling to Seattle, the University of Washington, and couldn't resist the greater Vancouver area, the gorgeous mountains and the ocean. So when I was offered a job at UBC in 2005, I jumped at the chance and was able to come back. And so I'm fortunate to have most of my family surrounding the area as well, which is terrific.
Lori, did you always have an interest in research? And why research about sex?
Yeah, it's an interesting story because I grew up in quite a conservative Italian Catholic family where we didn't talk about sex. And in fact, there were several sex negative messages that I was exposed to growing up. So no, I absolutely never intended to pursue a career where I was spending the majority of my time studying sex and offering sex therapy to people. But I did always have a long-standing interest in research. And it was as an undergraduate that I began volunteering in a lab. Really, it was the only lab that would take a first-year undergraduate because I had absolutely no research experience at all. And the scientist, the faculty member in that lab, was studying animal models of sexual dysfunction. So what that means is that as a student volunteer, I was injecting rats with different medications and then studying the impact on their sexual activities. And I did that for all of my undergrad and then for the next 2 years of my master's degree. And so for me, what it did is it absolutely cultivated that interest in science because it was a very controlled way of looking at when you manipulate X, what is the outcome on Y? And so we were studying things like the effects of antidepressants on sexual activity, the effects of chronic stress, the effects of melatonin, and other things. And essentially, I would study the rat's sexual behavior. And then it was really the year that Viagra was approved in Canada. So that was 1999. And it just so happened to be, I finished my master's degree, was about to start my PhD, looking for a new research project. And here we had Viagra, which was this blockbuster medication, very effective for men's sexual dysfunction. It was discreet. It was very effective. It was readily available. Anyone could get it. And at that same year in 1999 was published a large study looking at just how common sexual problems are in men and in women. So it was a large population-based prevalence study done in the United States. And the study struck me because it found that, yes, sexual concerns in men were very common, but they were twice as common in women. So about 43% of the women in the study reported having an ongoing sexual problem of at least 3 months over the last year. And so these two pieces of information, the fact that sexual concerns in women are so common, and we've got this effective, easy to use medication for men and nothing comparable for women, that really steered the course of my training towards leaving the rat lab and embarking on the study of women's sexuality after that point.
Wow, that's a fascinating journey. I see that you're also a registered psychologist in BC. Do you provide counseling privately as well as doing the research work?
Yeah. So because I was trained as I have a PhD in clinical psychology. And so throughout my research training, I also was trained in evidence-based psychological treatments. And it was a very general kind of training. So the most common concerns being anxiety and depression and stress and adjustments in living and that sort of thing. And then as my training went on, I really was able to obtain highly specialized training to manage sexual concerns. And then when I did my postdoc at the University of Washington, I really focused on sex therapy and the treatment of sexual dysfunction in men and women. So yeah, at the current time, I have a few different roles. I have my research role and have an amazing group of students and who lead the research in my lab. And then I have an administrative role where I run our provincial Women's Health Research Institute. And this really supports a lot of the research in women's health in the province. And then I also have a small private practice where I see clients privately. And that's primarily focused on sexual concerns in people of any gender, not just women.
Right, right. Have you had to transition to the telehealth scene the way so many people have during this crazy pandemic?
Yeah, I sure have. And, you know, I feel so fortunate that we have the technology to be able to continue most of the work that we're doing. So that includes my sex therapy work is entirely online. Our research, we were just in the middle of a couple of studies, including one study that we were just about to launch, and it involved running mindfulness groups for breast cancer survivors with sexual concerns. And we had funding, we had approval, we had everything lined up. We're just about to start running those groups. And then the COVID-19 pandemic hit. So fortunately, we were able to pivot pretty quickly. And we're now running those groups online, which is amazing because it means then we're able to also include women living in all parts of the province, including those in rural and remote areas who wouldn't be able to make it to the city center anyways. So yeah, I'd say the about 99% of all of our activities are now entirely virtual.
I just think that is an amazing and wonderful part of telehealth, is how you can now incorporate people who physically are not in your area. It's pretty fantastic.
Yeah. And when it comes to sexuality, you know, there are data that tell us that the majority of people really do suffer in silence. They don't talk to a healthcare provider. Many of them don't even tell a partner that they're struggling with sexual issues. And that that is really amplified or exacerbated for people who are living outside of major cities or living in rural and remote areas. So I really think that this is kind of a silver lining that is, you know, not to downplay all of the suffering that's happening right now with social isolation. It's terrible. But because we're really forced to jump on the technology bandwagon right now, for better or for worse, we're making the most of it and we're actually able to do things now that we were not able to do before.
So I just want to share with our listeners how committed you are to information dissemination and availability. I was really impressed that I could go to bratolab.com and click on publications, and all of your many publications were there with full text available. You can just read them all. You try to make yourself available to podcasts like ours and interviews where possible. And you are just out there spreading the word, which is about transparency and accessibility. And we at the pod salute you for that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I think it's so important that as scientists, we do that because after all, that's why we do the research, is so that it gets translated into something that is meaningful and accessible that ultimately can improve people's lives. And if we don't take those active steps to make the science readily accessible and also understandable. And that's, I think, a big part of it, because, you know, a lot of scientific writing is quite jargon filled and difficult to understand. So I want to thank you two for doing the podcast and having folks like me on it, that it's an opportunity to get the science out to the public.
Okay, well, let's dig a little deeper right now into a couple of the hats that you wear. What is a Canada Research Chair?
So it's a bit of a fancy title, but essentially these are federally funded salary awards for scientists across Canada who really specialize in a certain area. So you need to apply for them. They cover your salary. So my salary comes from this federal award as opposed to coming from the University of British Columbia. And because I'm named as a Canada Research Chair in women's sexual health, it is an opportunity for the government of Canada to kind of own that and say, you know, we take this area of science very seriously. In fact, so much so that we've invested money in a researcher who is going to devote their career to really advancing the science in this area. So there are many, many different Canada Research Chairs in different areas, and mine is the only one in sexual health in the country.
I'm a clinician for over 20 years, and I've been raising kids, and you know, I have my clinic. So I wasn't actually aware of these positions, but it's super impressive. And so well done, Lori, but also well done, Canada.
Yeah, I agree.
Forward, yeah. Canada's position in the world. That's excellent.
Thank you.
One of your other hats is as executive director of the Women's Health Research Initiative. Can you tell us what that's all about?
Yeah, so the Women's Health Research Institute, WHRI, we're a research institute. We're physically located on the grounds of BC Women's Hospital, but we're also a virtual research institute, and we have about 350 members across the province. And these are what we do, why we exist really is to support research in women's health. So we do that by providing core supports like research assistants and grant facilitation. So we have staff that really help people to secure funding by helping them identify grants and write those grants. We have biostatisticians to help people analyze their findings. We also do a lot in the way of knowledge translation. So we have staff that run workshops that actually teaches researchers how to disseminate their findings and how to work with policymakers and how to work with the public on disseminating their findings. So it's an administrative role, meaning that I'm the executive director and lead that institute and set the vision and the strategic direction of the institute, and then manage a large staff who then carry out the activities of the research institute. And we also work very closely with the BC Women's Health Foundation, really a core partner of ours, who do a lot of the fundraising around women's health and women's health research. And so through that partnership, we're able to run special grant competitions that are earmarked for women's health topics, also fundraising for graduate students to help support their salaries and their research in women's health. And we've made it a real priority to kind of set all of our strategies through an equity-based lens. And the reason that is so important is because we know that women's health research is grossly underfunded when we compare it to other areas of science, less than 10%. So really about 7 or 8% of all of the funding federally goes to women's health topics. And as a result of that, there's a lot we don't know about women's health and how to make women healthier. It's only been really in the last 20 years that women have been routinely included in research trials as well. So we've got a long way to go. But between our institute and our partnership with the foundation, we've actually made some amazing headways. We've been able to fund areas of women's health that actually have never been funded before. So it's a really, really important institute, and it's a role that I'm just so passionate about and absolutely love.
So more on that, like why is women's health research so important, and why is it such a hot button for you?
Yeah. So, you know, there are economic reasons definitely why it's important. So there have been lots of kind of global analyses that really prove that when women are healthy, all of society benefits. And it's not just mothers. And that's maybe a bit more of an obvious link, right? When moms are healthy, there's a better chance that their offspring are healthy. And that sort of continues on through the genetic line. But it extends beyond that. It actually shows that when women are healthy and thrive, they add diversity to tech sector, to businesses, to multiple different industries. We're seeing actually right now with the COVID crisis that it's predominantly women healthcare workers at the front lines. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, those same women are doing the juggling of taking care of the homes and homeschooling children. And, you know, they tend to be the point people for going out to get groceries. So there's a lot of evidence to support that it's important that we invest in making women healthy. The other thing I think that's really important and we can't ignore is that for so long, because research was focused just on men. And what I mean by that is that it was primarily men who were recruited to research studies because of the influence of women's fluctuating hormones. And for a long time, science saw the fluctuating menstrual cycle or pregnancy and breastfeeding as statistical confounds. So women were just simply not included in research trials. So even research that was studying women's topics, it was studied through the lens of male participants, which is a bit just mind-blowing. Thankfully, that has changed. But it does mean that there are so many areas of women's health that we still know little about. So for example, most medications, we don't have information on sex-specific doses or side effects or how effective they work and that sort of thing. So that, I think there's a big advocacy part of me as well. And this thriving on equity. And I think that when we have equity in our society, everyone benefits. It's not just about putting women on a pedestal, but truly everyone benefits when we do things equitably.
I've heard, others on the podcast say things like, if it's good for the girls, it's good for the boys. And if it's good for the boys, it's good for the girls. Like, we'll all get there together.
I agree.
So I actually felt, and I'm a women's health practitioner. I treat pelvic floor concerns. So often I'm talking with women about their sexual health and treating pain with intercourse, mm-hmm. incontinence, prolapse. So I pay some attention to women's health, and it's a hot button for me too. Mm-hmm. And I felt like in the last 12 to 18 months that really exciting things were happening in BC in relation mm-hmm. to women's health. Mm-hmm. I was invited to attend a workshop at Emily Carr's Health Design Lab, where other women's health practitioners brainstormed about a possible mature women's health center mm-hmm. at BC Women's Hospital. You must be familiar with this project.
I am, yes.
So many parts of what I learned there really sparked for me, like how they'd done this preliminary online survey for women, I think it was ages 45 to 70, and they were kind of told, well, you might get 100 responses. Mm-hmm. But in the month that that survey was up online, they had over 1,000 responses mm-hmm. from women who really had a lot to say about their experiences with accessing good information and advice, and about how they were doing in their midlife or perimenopausal to menopausal years. Pardon me. It seemed so honest mm-hmm. and that there were all these stakeholders and shareholders in the room being asked, okay, what do we need to do here to do this right? And so was the Women's Health Institute, Women's Health Research Institute involved in that project? Or is it sort of a parallel project?
Yeah. So this is really led by BC Women's Hospital. And they're another a core partner of ours. In fact, we sit on their grounds. They provide us space. And I work very closely with the leadership of BC Women's Hospital because, of course, our Women's Health Research Institute, we enable and lead all of the research that happens at BC Women's Hospital. So we work really closely with the leadership. And my involvement in the development and planning of the Mature Women's Health Center is really around how can we embed research into the development of this program right from its inception, so that we can make sure we understand what's working and what's not working, so that when if we need to make improvements, we can. So what I feel very fortunate about in my relationship with leadership and staff and directors at BC Women's Hospital is that they take research very seriously. And in fact, they see research as embedded in all of the work that they do. So when we have new research findings, we're able to translate that into clinical care and improvements in policies and the way we do things, because frankly, there are a lot of outdated clinical and medical practices that have not changed in spite of new research findings that show us that we should be doing things differently.
Mm-hmm. That actually makes me more excited about how much is being done for women and about women's health in British Columbia right now. That's amazing. So then I was also excited by the declaration of money earmarked for women's health research last year from the federal government, a sum of $1.4 billion annually starting in 2023 to support women and girls' health around the world. Do you know of which money I'm talking about?
I do. Yeah, I was actually a few rows away from Justin Trudeau when he announced that. He announced it at the Women Deliver conference. That was in June of 2019. It was in Vancouver, and Women Deliver is a large global powerhouse meeting of women and girls all over the world with the sole goal of improving equity and raising awareness around the importance of women's health. And so Sophie Gregoire Trudeau is an ambassador of Women Deliver. And so she was readily available throughout the 5 days of the meeting. And our Prime Minister Trudeau was there on the first day, and he made this announcement. And it's really about strengthening the work globally around sexual and reproductive health care research and rights. And, you know, we still have data that exists that show that women living in lower middle income countries face very, very high rates of gender-based violence, still have very high and unnecessary rates of cervical cancer, which is entirely preventable, that women are not accessing effective birth control methods, et cetera. And so the funding is really about improving all of that on a global scale. And I think, you know, to have a feminist government, federal government, which we do, we feel it's, I mean, I couldn't imagine being anywhere else and doing the research that we do.
That must have been a really exciting room to be in. I'm just reeling, and I might have to sneak in the door the next time it comes around. That's pretty cool.
It was amazing. Yeah, there were 8,000 people congregated at the Vancouver Convention Center, and about another 100,000 people that were logged on online. So it was, the energy in the room was just unbelievable.
Oh, wow. So the media at that time was like, hey, right on. And certainly I felt that was great. But my question to you is this enough? Mm-hmm. Is it enough?
Well, we could always use more. I want to start with gratitude. We are absolutely grateful because sexual and reproductive health care and all that that entails is a big part of women's health. And we know that unintended pregnancies, contributes to so many other negative health consequences and life consequences for women. So an unintended pregnancy can impact all of the future directions of a woman's life. So it's a core part. I mean, for women to be healthy, having sexual and reproductive health in check is critical. Is that enough? I'd argue no, because there are other facets of women's health and women's health research that are also in grave need of more support, like ensuring that our standards of care around the country, around the world, and especially in rural and remote areas is better. And, you know, when we hear stories about women having to take a 10-hour bus ride in order to have a pelvic exam or a different women's health investigation or see a qualified therapist, et cetera, that's not okay. It's really not okay, because those women are just simply not getting the absolute needed care that they deserve. So yeah, we still have a long way to go.
Fair enough. But I would say, with all of those things together, I started feeling like I was noticing a more positive affect in the world towards women's health research, more funding, more interest. Would you say that this is true?
I'd like to think so. It depends. It depends on the day, and it depends on what meetings I sit in. I would say that, you know, among those who are at the front lines and on the inside and doing this work, absolutely, it's so evident the impact that this is making. And then every once in a while, we butt up against groups or individuals who doubt that this is important and think that money should be invested in more important things. And sometimes we see those trolls online as well. And, and that's to be expected. I think what I have is cautious optimism that we're seeing some real change.
Fantastic.
Well, and then now there is COVID. The COVID-19 pandemic has necessitated a lot of personal and professional sacrifices for people around the world. And I'm just wondering, is research an area that was hit by the wave of closures and slowdowns due to COVID? Do you think there'll be an effect on funding for women's healthcare research? Or, you know, what do you see going forward?
Yeah, it's a great question. And understandably, the focus has really been on COVID. So what we've seen at the university, now we're going on our sixth week where all of research has been curtailed. What that means is basically research has stopped. Anything on site has stopped. Unless it's COVID-related research, then we have exemptions for that. So we've seen many research labs have to close down or stop, and we're seeing, unfortunately, the ripple effect of that on students, on funding, et cetera. But what we're also seeing is a lot of flexibility in different research labs redeploying their researchers and shifting onto COVID-related research. So I'll give you a small example. In my own lab, three of my students very early on in the pandemic in Canada said, you know, we have an opportunity to examine the impact on sexual health of our population, recognizing that we actually have learned a lot in past pandemics that we can jump off of. So, for example, in past pandemics, when people were socially confined, there were huge negative impacts on stress. And what we saw is actually isolation-induced increases in gender-based violence, which is just a tragic outcome of this, and people feeling trapped, women feeling trapped. So one of the studies that we launched Canada-wide a few weeks ago now was actually looking at the reasons that people are engaging in sexual activity. And that's kind of a sidebar line of interest in my own lab is motivations for sex, because it affects sexual desire and sexual dysfunction. So I guess one of the questions is are people engaging in more sexual activity, but that is, it's unwanted sexual activity. And the correlate of that is, are we seeing increasing non-consensual sexual activity? So we've been able to pivot and include questions around COVID. We've seen other research labs that have, you know, really taken this on and received funding to study things like the impact of COVID on pregnancy outcomes. So one of our local researchers, Dr. Deborah Money, is leading a national study looking at, you know, how does a COVID in pregnant mothers impact their subsequent health and their baby's subsequent health, and kind of tracking them over time. And there has been an increase in funding. So both provincial funding across the provinces, as well as federal funding devoted to studying COVID. As I'm sure you and all your listeners know, there are massive efforts devoted to trying to study the development of a vaccine, studying antibodies in people who have had COVID and trying to learn from that so we can close the gap on how quickly we can develop a vaccine. So what's amazing for me as a scientist is just to see the natural life cycle that research usually takes, which is, you know, what is it, maybe 3 to 5 years in vaccine development, is now being condensed into a fraction of that time because everyone is mobilized and really geared up to find that vaccine and make some meaningful scientific advances. So I think that's been a good thing. And the fact that they're doing this in the face of a pandemic, right? Like scientists are not immune to the stress of doing this. We all have other roles and families and stresses and have to get to the grocery store and all of those kinds of things too. So it's been pretty remarkable to watch.
So your own research has focused on a non-pharmacological approach to treating low desire and arousal for women. And you wrote a book about your techniques and your findings called Better Sex Through Mindfulness, How Women Can Cultivate Desire. And that was released in 2018. So congratulations on being an author.
Thank you.
Also, you're the author of a well-presented book. I felt that it was, you made the research really accessible for the reader. You don't have to be a scientist to understand what you are saying. And then I'll just give a shout out to the people that it's a book that actually includes some practical, like try this at home steps. So you don't need a lot of money or even access to a professional to benefit from the things that you found. Women could perceivably pick up that book and apply the techniques to their own lives and do so quite nicely on their own. Would you agree?
Well, thank you very much. And actually, just yesterday, we had our Society for Sex Therapy and Research meeting. It was supposed to be in Chicago. And of course, it was moved entirely online, and I was absolutely honored. I received the Health Professional Book Award yesterday for my book, Better Sex Through Mindfulness. The reason I wrote the book is in reference to what I had mentioned earlier, that so much science is kind of buried in medical journals that people don't read. And so it was an opportunity to take the science and translate it into a public-facing, very accessible way. And I also describe many of the mindfulness exercises that we do in our groups and lay them out in the book. So it's for women themselves to benefit from. Health professionals can use it and use it as a guide if they're incorporating mindfulness training into their own work with their patients. And then hopefully it's going to have some broader appeal to anyone who really wants to improve their sex lives by paying more attention.
Fantastic. Okay. So there are things that I'd like to highlight for folks out there. We're not going to tell them everything the book says, but what I propose is that we do a quick true and false round. Would that be okay?
Of course.
And feel free, of course, to pause and expound wherever you'd like to. And then after that little round, we have some things we want to dig deeper into.
Okay. So
Men and women are different when it comes to the arousal process. True or false?
Yes. So there are similarities and there are differences. I can expand or we can just do rapid fire.
Rapid fire.
Okay.
Okay. Women are multitaskers.
Yes.
Women are sandwiched often between kids, spouses, parents, jobs. In other words, they're often stressed.
Yes.
Stress and arousal and desire issues are linked.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, I don't know if you like women or not, but Freud had it wrong.
Yes.
Let's say orgasm, more commonly associated with clitoral stimulation.
Yes.
Vibrators are useful and fun.
Yes.
Mindfulness can improve your sex life.
Yes.
Mindfulness takes practice.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
That was a lot of yeses.
It was.
Well, let's take this back and let's dig in a little deeper to some of this stuff. We wanted to find a couple of the key biological concepts with regard to women's sexuality, and then we'll get back to how mindfulness plays into this stuff. So we've read about a couple of different concepts of sexual responses postulated by another impressive local, Dr. Rosemary Basson. One of these is called the circular model of desire, and the other is called responsive desire. Can you tell us a little more about these and why, what's different about them?
Yes, and thank you for asking that question because it taps into a prevailing myth that exists in our society, and that is if you're not in the mood for sex and feel desire spontaneously out of the blue, then there's something wrong with you. And it leaves a lot of people, a lot of women in particular, especially those in longer-term relationships, it leaves them feeling broken if they don't feel in the mood for sex out of the blue. And it's completely not supported by the research whatsoever. So we set aside that notion of spontaneous desire and we say, you know, if you have that every once in a while, great, act on it, enjoy it, take it on, celebrate it, but don't rely on it as your sole way of experiencing sexual desire. So what Dr. Basson articulated back in 2000 was this idea that sexual desire is really responsive. And so what that means is that we don't have to wait for sexual desire to engage in sexual activity, but instead you can make a decision to engage in sexual activity for any number of reasons. And a sidebar is that there's been quite a bit of research studying what are those reasons that people give for engaging in sex. And they run the gamut from, you know, I want to connect with my partner, to I want to have an orgasm, to it helps me get to sleep, I want to celebrate a birthday, it's a way to get revenge, it's, you know, the list goes on, and there's 200 plus distinct reasons. But the idea is that you don't have to feel desire in order to go on to engage in a sexual activity. But that once you do, and here's where mindfulness becomes really important, because mindfulness really is about tuning into the experience so that you feel what's happening. You feel arousal starting. The brain and body are connecting and communicating with one another. And then when that happens, desire responds to that. So desire can emerge during a sexual encounter. That's why we call it responsive. So it's this idea that arousal happens first and then desire emerges after that. And that's normal and it's common. And in probably is the way that most people, most women experience their sexual desire. And it's circular because the outcome of that is if the sexual encounter is rewarding for a person, then that will reinforce her kind of engaging in a similar cycle the next time that she wants to engage in sex.
I wanted to ask you also about arousal non-concordance or disconcordance. Are these concepts the same? Or can you tell us more about what they are?
So arousal discordance is when, we've studied this for a long time in the research lab. And in fact, my own lab at UBC has a way of studying this where we bring women into a private room. They sit on a comfortable reclining chair. They self-insert a vaginal probe. And this probe is small, looks like a tampon. And then they watch some brief erotic films. And their hand is resting on a recliner on a mouse that they can move back and forth to correspond to how turned on they are in their mind as they're watching their erotic films. And for years and years, what we found is that the body's arousal in response to erotica doesn't necessarily go along with how aroused a woman is in her mind. And very often what we see is that the body can automatically respond, almost like a reflex, in response to seeing something erotic. And her mind might take a bit longer, or she might be not turned on, or in fact turned off. So this notion that you can have discordance, the mind's arousal and the body's arousal not agreeing with each other or not in alignment, is a feature of women's sexual arousal. With men, on the other hand, you see a high concordance. If the body's aroused, chances are the mind is aroused and vice versa. And this is kind of a normal feature of women's arousal that has a lot of consequences and clinical implications as well.
So let's take that now over to mindfulness. From your perspective, what is it?
Because we know that for women's sexual concerns, that psychological factors are really front and center. And it's not to downplay the importance of medical, biological, and hormonal factors. Those are all really important. But the research tells us that psychological factors like mood, stress, attention, sense of well-being, body image, those predict a woman's sexual desire far more than those more biomedical factors. And it turns out that distractions during sex are really common and a major contributor of low desire, as are women's tendency to have negative thoughts about sex. And so psychologists, we call this catastrophizing. So this would be if the woman during a sexual encounter is worried about the outcome. So she might be thinking to herself, oh gosh, what if I don't have an orgasm? How is my partner going to respond to this? Will my partner think less of me? Will my partner leave me? Will this reinforce the fact that we're not sexually compatible? So because we know that distractions during sex and negative thoughts during sex are so key, they're so predictive of women's low desire, it makes a lot of sense that a strategy which is designed to keep people in the here and now and rooted in their physical sensations in their body and not lost in thoughts makes a lot of sense. So we've been studying and adapting mindfulness-based interventions. Really, my first study started in 2002 with cancer survivors who had sexual concerns. And over the last 18 or so years, we've adapted this to many different populations of women. And I can say pretty confidently now, based on the research, that it works. So we've done this in group format with women and with men, I'll say as well. We've done studies with men. We've done this in individual format, so one-on-one, and also in couple format. And we've followed women over time, a year after they've completed our groups. And the benefits to their desire, the benefits to their sense of sexual satisfaction and relationship happiness and mood persist over time. So I'm pretty convinced that mindfulness is such a powerful, and in fact, I would say really a core required ingredient for healthy sexuality.
Yeah. So I often help clients, women, female clients who have pain with intercourse. They're unable to have sort of the typical conventional something in vagina, we'll say penis in vagina sex, mm-hmm. because it hurts, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And so I tell them about what goes on in the physio room. It's largely going to focus on the physical realities of sex that mm-hmm. A needs to fit into B. Mm-hmm. And it's often quite successful. I can get women to the place where things can go in and out of their vaginas and it's not painful anymore, which is totally a victory. It's fantastic. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't always mean that just because it's not hurting, they're now having a good time.
Right. Right.
Right. And I think not just not hurting, while that's great, it's not good enough. Yeah. I want way more for my patients. I want them to get enjoyment and pleasure out of their bodies. And so what I think I see with the work that you've done is a way that women can work on this aspect of their potential sexual dysfunction when they've gotten past hurdle A. There might be hurdle B to deal with, but it's pretty low financial cost. Mm-hmm. It's not a pharmaceutical, so no negative side effects. It's really a win-win to spend some time working on this technique.
Yeah. And, you know, Jillian, I work really closely with pelvic floor physiotherapists for the reasons that you've just described. And, you know, we tag team with one another because, of course, the pelvic floor physiotherapists have the ability to really work on the functional and rehabilitative sides of allowing, you know, device B into slot A. Mm-hmm. And then my role is, how do we infuse pleasure into that? And so often what happens is, as a woman is seeing her pelvic floor physiotherapist and they've made some progress, I will then see the woman for a number of sessions and teach her mindfulness strategies to actually feel again. And we do that very simply, shall I say, by just observing sensations. So what you can also do is, as she's, say, inserting a vaginal dilator or insert or dildo at home, you can incorporate mindfulness into that. So rather than doing it while she's being distracted or, you know, watching TV or zoning out, you can actually layer a mindfulness practice onto that where she's fully observing and feeling the sensations and really getting well practiced in noticing her body. And then we ramp it up from there. So we might pair that with an arousing activity like using a vibrator or reading some erotic literature, where arousal starts in her body, and then she can apply those same awareness skills to noticing arousal. And then that might happen over a series of sessions, and there might be a need for some more pelvic floor physiotherapy after that if there's still pain or difficulty with penetration. So it's this kind of beautiful harmony of working together with different healthcare providers, and mindfulness is you can see it threaded throughout the different aspects of our complementary work.
Absolutely. And you're right. It's a great tag team.
So, Lori, you focus on women, but we did notice one study related to attention that might be important for our male listeners with erectile dysfunction. This research indicated that while a man focused on a woman's mounting excitement and arousal, he became more excited himself. So if he focused on himself, however, his erection began to wane. Is a mindful approach then good news for guys with erectile dysfunctions too?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked that question because, you know, I think my work has definitely resonated highly with women, and it's gotten a lot of attention from a women's health perspective. But, you know, men also have high rates of sexual concerns. Low desire in men is really common. Erectile dysfunction or problems getting or keeping an erection is also really common, but less common than low desire in men. And I see actually a lot of young men with low desire issues. So in my practice, my clinical practice, I see women and men, in fact, people of all genders, non-binary people and trans people as well. And we've now done a few studies adapting mindfulness to different populations of men. So we've published on the use of mindfulness as a tool for men who have what's called situational erectile dysfunction. It's kind of a jargony phrase that means that these are men who have no problems getting and keeping erections when they're on their own masturbating, but they lose their erections when they're with a partner. So there's a lot of performance issues, anxiety, catastrophic thoughts that happen in this subsample of men. And so mindfulness, again, which is about how do you stay in the here and now and ward off that tendency to worry about the outcome and just notice sensations as they're unfolding in the here and now. And we found that it worked for men with situational erectile concerns. And then we've also been over the last 2 years applying this to prostate cancer survivors who have erectile dysfunction and doing this with the men together with their partners and have had some really promising findings in that study as well.
I was just thinking that in the situation of working with couples, it seems like that would be a really interesting place to play as well. You know, there are the individuals and feeling their individual states, but it's a whole other thing when you've got the two together, like a whole other almost entity when you've got two people together paying attention to each other's arousal.
Yeah. And it's sort of mindfulness squared when you can do this with two people, because you have each person becoming aware of their own body sensations and what's happening. But then you also can focus on the points of contact between those two people. And it's super, super powerful. I mean, I'd love for someone to study and write much more about mindfulness in couples.
And Dr. Brado, for our last question this morning that we ask everybody who comes on the pod, in your perspective, what is health?
What is health? Wow. That's a big question that I was not prepared for. You know, health is, I think, a state of physical, emotional, spiritual well-being. And of course, that looks different for different people in different ways. And it might be that different parts of that are healthier than other parts of that. But I think that there's a big subjective component to that. It's you know, kind of your sense of wellness. And, you know, I would argue, I think those who do work in this area would argue that sexual health is a core part of health. That when sexual health is in check, that overall health is also better and in check too.
That's a great answer. Unprepared or not, great answer. So thank you, Dr. Brado, for your perseverance in shining a light on research for women's health, on improving sexual health for women, because what benefits women benefits men. And on being a really amazing example of leadership, of excellence in leadership, research, and education.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you both for the conversation and the opportunity, and really this vehicle of sharing the findings with your listeners. And I hope that it inspires them.
That's all for today's small conversation. We hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. We will provide links to Lori's book, Better Sex Through Mindfulness, How Women Cultivate Desire, and brottolab.com in the show notes. If you like the episode, Dr. Brado invites you to share on social media with the hashtag #debunkingdesire and tagging at Dr. Lori Brado and at UBCSHR. We'll be here next time.
And we'll have the coffee on.
If you liked what you heard, we encourage you to head on over to iTunes and leave us a 5-star review. Better yet, subscribe and leave a review. That really helps to make it easier for others to find us, to help broaden this small conversation.